I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales. Visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:10 Wednesday, July 7th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And I hope you're ready to say goodbye to these Zoom backgrounds.
Yes, apparently we will be back in the studio next week. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And, you know, as I do, we're all obsessed with John Green. And I was thinking about him. He buys and sells horses. He writes columns for the TDN. He's as funny as can be. He's the Henny Youngman of the modern era. He appears on the Zoom show. I think I've given him a new title. He's the Shohei Ohtani of the Thoroughbred world. How do you like that, John?
Wow. That is tremendous.
And he takes care of cats.
And on top of all that, this is John Green, general manager at DJ Stable. I'm also a humanitarian. And Michelle, my wife and I have been fostering kittens for the past 2 weeks. And they are going back to the SPCA this week to start their countdown. So if you'd like to adopt any of these adorable cats, this is Pepper.
Cinnamon. Spicy.
And they're all excellent cats. They're all very well housebroken, and they actually watch racing on TV. So if you want to have a permanent, lifetime, partner that won't argue with you and that will always let you pick whatever's on the TV, go to the Monmouth County SPCA, .org, I believe it is. But Monmouth County SPCA, there's a bunch of kittens that are available, but we can vouch for these three. Michelle, you want to put Spice in? There you go. In there. And the best part about it is, Bill, they laugh at all of my jokes.
All right. Guess we don't need a guest today. We'll just throw the cats on. This is the great group guest of the week.
Those are the guests of the week. Exactly.
Nice to see them and nice to see Michelle as well. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September yearling sale beginning Monday, September 13th. Learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I just want to bring John in on this real quick, because they changed the format this year. Usually the dark days between books one and two. This year they're going to have a two-day book one, then a two-day book two, and then a dark day, and then the rest of the books. How does that change your approach, if at all, John?
Joe, I think this is a phenomenal opportunity because basically, Keeneland is a two-week sale, and it goes in order of the best horses, at least from a pedigree standpoint, all the way down to the ones that don't have as much commercial appeal. So there's a natural break, in pricing and in pedigree, usually between book two and three. Some can argue between three and four. But what's nice is that if you go down for the sale, it really breaks it up. It breaks it up between the top quality horses, and then you get a day to reset. And for those who go to the sales, that's such a mental and physical, necessity, is to have that extra day to reset. To basically, because it's a grind. You look at so many horses, you're trying to find the best horses. There's constant pressure to make the right decisions. So you have a day to breathe and you have a day to meet with people and talk to people and regroup and see what you bought. And more importantly, what's coming down the pike for the next week. I think it's an outstanding idea. I'm very pleased. I even, for a few times that I tweeted kudos to Keeneland for putting that, block, that date in there on that Friday, because it's just a natural break and it's a natural travel day too for people who leave after the first couple of books and people who come in for the real meat and potato horses that come up in book three through six. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I'm even wearing my Keeneland shirt with pride today because of that decision.
Attaboy. As much as we're honored for Keeneland to sponsor the show, they should be equally as honored to get a John Green tweet right up there. All right, so we talked last week about how much graded stakes action there was pretty much across the country. It was a terrific holiday weekend of racing. I think notable horses that ran and won over the weekend. So we're gonna split this up into two bits. But the first part, I wanted to talk about the Suburban, because I feel like the Suburban was the biggest race of the weekend, and I thought the result was interesting in that it kind of opened the door a little bit in the handicap division. That was my feeling, at least watching the race, because, as soon as Mystic Guide got through on the inside, I thought that race was over. I thought it was lights out, even with the layoff coming back from Dubai, you know, he ran, I think, his best race of his life previously on a sloppy track. So I thought he was going to eat up that wet track that we had on Saturday at Belmont. But he just got hooked by Max Player and couldn't put him away in the final 16th. And I think, you know, that combined with the effort from Nick's Go on Friday night in the Cornhusker kind of, you know, made me rethink the handicap division a little bit, as well as Maxfield. I don't want to slight him. I think he's in there as well, because, you know, my feeling was Mystic Guide, if he ran back to either of those races from the Dubai World Cup, or especially the Razorback, I thought that he was going to be very tough to beat for the rest of the year. Now with this kind of clunker, I don't want to say it's a clunker too much, because he still ran second in a big race. You know, he was a close second, but he only got a 101 buyer figure. This was the first time that I felt like he took a step backwards. You know, I think every other race he's run in his career, what's been nice about him is there's been steady development from race to race. And you really like to see that, you know, with an older horse especially. This was the first time he took a step back. Now, you can say that it was the Dubai bounce. It was off the layoff. We've certainly seen other horses in the past come off of the plane from Dubai, and they're just not the same in their next start for whatever reason. But we've also seen horses come back and run terrific races as well. Gun Runner comes to mind a couple of years ago, and the Stephen Foster. So I'm curious as to what you guys think, whether you're willing to just chalk that up as the Dubai bounce and a one-off thing, or if you think, like I do, that this potentially opens the door for a much more competitive handicap division, especially with Nick's Go and Maxfield's recent results. Nick's Go, by the way, got a 113 buyer for his blowout win in the Cornhusker. Wondering what you guys thought about those results.
Yeah, Joe, I agree. It is somewhat of a shuffling of the deck and a couple points of that. First of all, though, I think what we're looking at is a pretty wide open handicap division. There are four or five very, very good horses, but nobody, I think, stands out. And especially now, if Mystic Guide went and won this race by 5-6 lengths, we'd say, look, he's a no-brainer as the number one horse, be the favorite in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, probably win that, then go into the Breeders' Cup Classic as the favorite. Now you can shuffle the deck a little bit. And I think, you know, again, I'll say, like, if they ran the Breeders' Cup tomorrow, what would you have? You'd probably have, again, four or five horses all within, you know, the price range of maybe 5-2 to 4 or 5-1, something like that, which makes for a good racing, good betting race, et cetera. A couple of thoughts. I mean, you're right. The story of the weekend, you nailed the two stories of the weekend. One was the Suburban. The other was Nick's Go. I mean, I get it. It was only the Cornhusker handicap race that really nobody pays any attention to in normal years. He didn't run against much, but he's back. I mean, after a dull effort in the Met Mile, he wins by 10.25, 113 buyer. However, and I haven't heard what Brad Cox has to say about this, but would he really point towards the Breeders' Cup Classic with him? I don't see him as a 1.25 horse. I think he'd likely be back in the dirt mile. And then kind of getting off the subject a little bit, the Suburban was one of the reasons why we as horse players are always tearing our hair out. You look at Max Player, he was 6th in the Pimlico Special in his previous race. He was terrible in the Saudi Cup. He hadn't won since the Withers of 2020. His figures weren't any good. If you posted that horse at 30-40-1, I would not have been interested in betting him. He wins at 11-1, and I just feel stupid. How does everybody in the world understand this? What am I missing? That's when you feel hopeless as a horse player. It's a really bad races like that really are a bad feeling. It makes you realize, to me, maybe you guys say, Bill, you're crazy. He looked great. I loved him. I thought he had a huge chance. I wouldn't have bet counterfeit money. I wouldn't have bet Monopoly money on this horse at 11-1. So, you know, I don't get it.
I think, Bill, what you have to look at in hindsight, with 2020 hindsight, you know, having perfect vision, is that everything lined up absolutely perfectly for Max Player to win. You had a dull effort by Mystic Guide, albeit coming, you know, from overseas, hadn't run since March, and a horse is going to throw one like that. And you say, gee, he ran second. Is that really a dull effort? It kind of was. Like, kind of that last eighth of a mile, he kind of hung a little bit. But also, it was on a sloppy sealed racetrack, which is right up his alley, Max Player's alley. And I think those variables really benefited Max Player. That being said, you're right. I can see that you did pull your hair out a lot, over this race, Bill, and I understand why. And as far as Nick's Go, I think he will go to the mile of the Breeders' Cup, and that ultimately is where they're going to go. But this race of Nick's Go reminded me of a scene from a very famous movie. And the fact that that Brad Cox brought the horse into Iowa to run in a, you know, in a grade three prairie meadow to kind of get the horse's confidence back. He was basically coming in and stealing everybody's lunch. And the scene that I remember is the very last scene of Daniel Day-Lewis's There Will Be Blood, where he stood there and he said, if you have a milkshake and I have a milkshake and I drink my milkshake and I have a straw and I drink all of your milkshake from across the way, that is, you know, that is America, and I drink your milkshake. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But the point of the matter is that he basically came in and stole that money, into Iowa. And I think gave all the Iowans a great idea of what a really good horse looks like. But I just kept harkening back to they're stealing money, they're stealing somebody's milkshake. And you know, it just I didn't do a good, you know, I do a better Henny Youngman than I do with Daniel Day-Lewis. But the bottom line is, I think that they showed what a really, you know, top athlete looks like to the wonderful people of Iowa.
Yeah, thanks for John for that stirring reenactment, because we can't afford the footage from the movie to actually show on the podcast. But, you know, just to go back to Bill's point, you know, if you're a thoroughbred player, Max Player made some sense. The way that I looked at the race and the way that it shaped up on thoroughbred figures, Mystic Guy got a -5 in the Oaklawn race. He got a -2.75 in the Dubai World Cup. The only other horse in the entire race who had run a negative figure was Informative, the Uriah St. Louis big long shot. Everybody else had run like 0.5 or 1.25. To me, the reason the race had value was Super Saver or Happy Saver, rather. Happy Saver, I thought, was an overbet horse. I said this before the race. I'm not just saying it afterwards. They ran fourth or whatever it was. I thought there should have been a much bigger gap between Mystic Guide and Happy Saver and the rest of the field. I think people just get so enamored with these undefeated horses that they think, you know, they automatically assume forward movement. Whereas, you know, other horses that have already run those kind of fast races, you know, even if they're a little blemished, they don't get the same kind of, you know, credit from the bettors. So I thought that was, you know, the value of the race. And I didn't think Max Player was impossible. I did need Mystic Guide in there, but I had a little Saver Exacta, so it worked out okay. But yeah, I mean, as far as Nick's goes, I think that's the interesting part the rest of the year is, you know, he's probably gonna end up in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile again. But in between then, I think there are a couple of chances for him to meet up with the top level handicap horses, namely in the Whitney, because the Whitney is 1.125. It's not 1.25. And if he's not going to run in the Whitney between now and the Breeders' Cup, like where is his big mile race that he's going to get to run in? You know, the Met Mile was basically it. You can wait for the Kelso, I guess, at Belmont in the fall. But that's, you know, it's logical that he and Mystic Guy, I think, will end up in the Whitney, and that'll be a terrific matchup. Just because, you know, I don't know. I think it's hard to judge Nick's go because he runs these monster races against lesser competition. And then when he gets to the top level competition, he just doesn't show up the same way. You know, you could say he won the Pegasus. That's technically a grade one race. I think we all know that that field this year was not really a grade one field. Then he runs in the Saudi Cup, has really, you know, pace was pretty fast, but really has nothing in the stretch. And then he runs in the Met Mile first off the plane and just, you know, really didn't lift a foot at all as an odds on favorite. So it's tough to figure out what to make of him. He seems like the kind of guy who just, you know, kind of horse who just pounds on this lower level competition and then just doesn't bring it for whatever reason in the same way against the grade one horses. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what he does the rest of the year. He obviously is super, super fast. I think as far as I know, 1.13 is the fastest buyer anybody's run this year. I don't think anybody else has run faster than that. But those, you know, the Mystic Guide loss coupled with that performance by Nick Sko, I thought at least opened the door to a very interesting matchup in the Whitney and perhaps one or two other times for the rest of the year. So I think the handicap division definitely got more interesting. We'll get to what happened in the rest of the divisions after this break from Keeneland.
The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 25th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Owning great stakes winning racehorses like Decorated Invader, now First Captain, is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtv.com. So there are a couple other results that we wanted to note from the weekend. In the John Nayrud with Mind Control winning, I thought that that was a pretty interesting performance. First of all, it was the first race for Todd Pletcher. He'd been transferred from Greg Sacco's barn to Todd Pletcher. I thought Greg Sacco did a great job with him. But the one thing that I thought going into the race, and the reason I liked him a little bit, was that there was very little speed in the race. And I thought that Todd Pletcher was training Mind Control with the idea of using his long lost speed. Because if you remember back in the day when he won the hopeful as a 2-year old, he went wire to wire and he had speed once upon a time. And then I think just over time, he maybe got a little bit less interested early in the races and became kind of a one run closer type. And this was not the spot to be a one run closer with Firenze Fire looming is the only speed as a huge, huge favorite. And I thought it was a brilliant ride as usual by John Velasquez, because Mind Control was a little half step slow out of the gate and he sent him and used his speed and he got through and was able to press Firenze Fire from the jump. And those two put on a pretty damn good show, I thought, in the stretch with Mind Control just surging past Firenze Fire late to prevail. Got a 99 buyer. He's a very admirable horse who I think shows up every time. They both are. Firenze Fire too is another horse who shows up every time. He's obviously got a ton of wins, especially at Belmont. But I thought that ride by John Velasquez made the difference, because if he gets pinched back and has to loop the field and try to run down Firenze Fire, who would have gotten an even easier lead if Velasquez wasn't aggressive, then he has no chance in the race. I thought that was terrific ride by Johnny V, and I thought a pretty good training job by Ty Fletcher too to get that speed out of him again. In the Dwyer, First Captain ran pretty well as an odds-on favorite. We're going to talk to Terry Finley a little bit later about him and some other stuff. He's an interesting horse, because I feel like he just takes a little bit of a while to get going, to where I think he's going to be much better going two turns than he is at one turn. If you watch all three of his races, you know, he in his first race, he looked beaten at the eighth pole and came flying late to just get up, beating Mahamal, who ended up being a pretty nice horse in the sloppy mile race that he had next out. You know, he looked a little like he was idling a little bit in mid stretch, came back along the inside and ended up kicking away in the end. And the same thing on Sunday or Monday in the Dwyer, looked like he was idling on the turn. It looked a little dicey there for a 2-5 favorite, but he came alive in a stretch and he really accelerates that final furlong. So I really can't wait to see him go two turns. Guessing that Jim Dandy will be next with him. He hinted at that, followed by the Travers. Gouffo was back on the winning side in the Grand Couturier Stakes. So that was the main action at Belmont. And then over the weekend, we also had some races at Los Al that were relevant, not only because they were great stakes, but because of the trainer of the winner. Now, Bob Baffert won both races at Los Al. He won the Los Alamitos Derby with Classier. He ran 1-2 in that race. Defunded was a close second. And then he won the Great Lady M Stakes with Gamine, who romped. She only got a 98 buyer. I wonder if she's the same horse as a 4-year-old as she was last year. She wasn't that great in the Derby City Distaff either, or the Humana, whatever that race is called now, that grade one race for fillies and mares on the Derby undercard. She hasn't wowed me so much this year as she has last year. But also, what's she going to do for the rest of the summer? You know, this is going to be an ongoing topic with Bob Baffert, who is kind of seems like a fugitive right now in terms of where he can run his horses. You know, he's contained, I think, and confined right now to California, because, you know, Del Mar is a great meet, but other than the Pacific Classic, there aren't a ton of top level grade one races for horses like Gamine. You know, the Rancho Bernardo is the only, you know, graded stake for fillies and mares over there. He could run her against the boys in the Pat O'Brien. But I'm curious what you guys think about this, you know, influx situation that Bob Baffert finds himself in, where he's usually pointing these horses to Saratoga to raid in and get those grade one wins. And he can't do that right now. What do you think is coming next for him and Gamine and those horses?
Yeah, well, we're really seeing this affect Baffert, and not only from what you just mentioned, Joe, but, you know, think of the horses we know that have been taken away from him, most of whom are horses that are likely to run at the Saratoga meet. Starting with kind of one at a time, well, you're a tough guy to please. Say, Gamine's not the same this year. She's 3-for-3 undefeated and has a grade one win. You know what to make of it. She's paced 2-to-5 in a race where she'd have to fall down 6 times to lose. And you're right, it's fascinating now because unless the owner, Michael Peterson, transfers her to another trainer, which he has given no indication that he's going to, her options are really limited because the Ballerina is the no-brainer next start for her one-turn grade one at Saratoga. So with that possibility taken away from him, maybe she does show up in that race at Del Mar that you mentioned. But, you know, she's too good for something like that. She belongs in the Ballerina. So far as Baffert running 1-2 in the Los Alamitos Derby, again, you would say, well, would those two horses perhaps be pointed now for the Travers or something like that? Maybe, but I can't get the least bit excited over class here. He ran an 89 buyer and his start before this race, which really came up light. He was third by 12 and a half lengths in the Affirm stake. So I don't get excited about him at all. But you know, the Baffert is an ongoing story, and you're right, he's kind of a little bit in, you know, like he's like somebody on parole right now. You know, he can only half go throughout his normal routine. And getting away from the subject a little bit, I agree 100% what you said about First Captain. Nice horse, but boy, talk about a horse that doesn't take your breath away. He's just a grinder. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And I do think he will be better when he goes longer, which will presumably be at Saratoga next time out. But, you know, he had to run down Ryden with Biden, who was 11-12-1 shot, you know, and got a very easy trip. But, you know, when we talk about some of these horses out there that are electrifying, he's exact opposite. He's just workmanlike grinder, got a 90 buyer figure, I believe. But, you know, the one thing about McGahee is his horses are not going to run their Shug McGahee. His horses are not going to run their best race in their third, fourth lifetime starts. They're going to run their best races in their ninth and 10th lifetime starts. So, you know, onward and upward with him. We'll see what he does coming out, but he's got a little bit more to prove, no doubt about it.
Well, you guys are a tough freaking audience. You don't like the way that Gamine won. You say that First Captain is a grinder and you know, it was a yawn kind of win. If you guys own these freaking animals, you'd be like, oh my God, you'd be making t-shirts. You'd be, you know, selling, buying ads on the TDN website and trying to campaign for them to be, you know, rising stars, for God's sake. You gotta accept and embrace when you have a nice horse like Gamine. And I know I've been on her bandwagon for almost from the beginning. You know, she's 8-of-9. The only blemish on her record was when she got DQ'd going 1 1/8 in the Kentucky Oaks. And oh, by the way, all she lost to was She Dares the Devil and Swiss Skydiver, who ended up being like 2 of the top 3 horses in the Eclipse standings for that category. And she was running, you know, way above her weight in the sense of going 9 furlongs versus, you know, 6 or 7 furlongs that is in her sweet spot. She won by 10 lengths and a hand ride, Gamine did, and was 2/5 of a second off the track record. You got to give me this. I mean, she is an awesome, awesome horse. Now, look, if she was trained by anybody else, I think we'd be campaigning for her to be champion, you know, sprinter for the fillies, champion sprinter, and basically couldn't wait for her and Cece, for example, to battle in the Breeders' Cup, you know, filly and mare sprint. I think that we have to pump the brakes a little bit on how, you know, just how negative we are on some of these horses. Because she's going to be a Hall of Famer. I mean, you know, short of, you know, somebody saying, well, I'm not going to vote for a Baffert trained horse. I think she's done enough to show that she is the good. She was a 1,000,008 yearling. She's bred up the wazoo. She's danced every dance. She's won multiple grade ones. You know, all she can do is beat the horses that are in the race with her. And she did it with, you know, with class. And I'm looking forward to watching her campaign. She never had to come back because she was always on the top. Okay. So we'll leave it, you know, we'll go with that. And First Captain, for God's sake, guys, here's a Curlin son out of an AP Indy mare, bred up the wazoo, you know, is from one of the royalist families that we know in American racing. And just because he's been going one turn races his entire career, all three races, that's why he's not exciting. I think when he starts going a mile and eighth and a mile and a quarter, it's not going to look like he's grinding past horses. It's going to look like he's accelerating past horses because he's bred to do it. And a lot of horses don't have the ability or the wherewithal to go that extra eighth or quarter of a mile. So again, I think that we have to look at it through a different prism and say, here's a horse that's only run three times in his life. And really he shouldn't be running one turn races, but that's the way that it's being set up. And Shug and West Point Thoroughbred are doing it the right way by improving his class that he's running against and increasing the distance. And that's old school, which is no surprise for Shug McGahee. But let's let the jury, you know, remain out on his on first captain's abilities until he goes two turns. I really think that we're short selling him, and that he's going to be a really nice horse as he continues to grow and develop. Because even though it's midway through his 3-year-old year, he really should be. I mean, he's bred to run a mile and a quarter as a 3, 4, and 5-year-old.
I mean, I'm agreeing with you on that, Bill, who has his hand raised right now for some reason. Is the one that's dumping on first captain. I think it's going to be hard to judge how good he really is until he gets around to two turns. And John, how about John putting Gamin in the Hall of Fame already? That's, you know, it feels like he has to keep one-upping himself and the irrational Gamin love that, you know, soon he'll be advocating they build a statue for her at Los Alamitos or wherever Baffert can still run.
That's in the world. That's definitely the worst. It was going to be at Naira. They're going to replace the secretariat, one, but he's not allowed to be in there now.
Question. Has there ever been a twice disqualified for drugs horse in the Hall of Fame? That's a stumper.
I don't know. And I don't want to equate her to Barry Bonds, but I remember at one point when Barry Bonds was getting very frustrated with all the questioning, he basically said, look, even if I was using steroids, that doesn't necessarily mean that I could still hit the ball over the fence. You know, like you still have to have the talent to hit the ball over the fence. I think for her, she still has the talent. It's just a question of, you know, is it being enhanced or not? I don't know. That's for greater minds than mine. All I can tell you is that I think that she's done everything you could ask of a filly to do in spades.
I don't know how Michael Lund Peterson hasn't sent you some gear, like a hat or shirt to wear on the show. He must not watch.
Am I that much of a clothes whore where I would stump for a horse because I get a t-shirt?
Yeah, you're wearing the Keeneland shirt right now. You're already kissing up to Keeneland, so you might as well.
Twice.
Yeah, who doesn't love a free shirt?
We got to ask Terry Finley for new shirts when he comes on as our guest.
Yeah, that's definitely the first question we should ask him.
Bill gets a first captain shirt.
or Finer Park. We got a Finer Park polo for Bill too. That'd be good. So one other result I wanted to mention. Yapan, who was a very, very nice 3-year-old last year, was undefeated through 4 starts and then got beat up a little bit in the Breeders' Cup sprint on a fast pace as the favorite. He came back in a stake at Pimlico on Sunday and really won very nicely, ran like 109.2, came home very fast, which is not, you know, typical on that track to clock 109 and change. Got a 101 buyer. So he's a horse that I think is very interesting. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership involves you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
This week's TDN Story of the Week is brought to you by the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Find out how you can get involved in racehorse ownership in Canterbury Park this summer with several options and investments ranging from $250 to $10,000. Visit racehorseminnesota.com to learn more. Okay, so this is the story of the week. This week is just a little bit of a follow-up on something that we reported on last month, which was the raids at parks. There was these kind of unannounced overnight raids that I think Tom Chuckus, who's the Pennsylvania Horse Racing Commission guy, said resulted in significant contraband. But then he kind of walked that back a little bit a little later on and said that there really wasn't anything of substance there. But now it seems like there was, because yesterday it was reported in the TDN, it was first reported in the Pollock report, that that trainer Richard Vega, who we thought was kind of the main target of those raids because he had had to scratch his horses the following couple of days after the raid, he's been hit with a 2-year suspension by the Pennsylvania Racing Commission from the May 25th backstretch raid that allegedly turned up a number of needles and loaded syringes in his tack room. Now, the rule generally is that trainers are not supposed to be in possession of those things. Only veterinarians are, regardless of what the substance is. Bill did some reporting on this and talked to Richard Vega's lawyer. I'm going to toss it to him and then we can react. What did you learn from doing that story yesterday, Bill?
Well, Joe, not a whole lot, to be honest with you, other than he got suspended. Obviously, he is appealing it. And the lawyer is, you know, as lawyers will be, is confident that at the end of the day, everything will be fine. Be that as it may, we don't really know. But I want to take it around, Joe, and see if you want to jump in, and if John could just hold on a minute. In the many episodes we've been doing of the show, one of your main themes has been how you're so tired of guys who break the rules getting slaps on the wrist. And to me, the significance of this story is they didn't slap him on the wrist. They beat him upside the head here. Is the game now changing? Are regulators now looking at it differently? 2 years, that's a very, very hefty penalty. And I'm not sure 2-3 years ago is something we would have seen. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't have given him 10 days or something like that, but might they have given a guy like this 2 months for an offense like this? So if you want to tackle it, John wants to tackle it, whatever. But to me, that was the story here. And, you know, a regulator decided at the end of the day, we're not taking this stuff anymore. 2 years, pal.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a huge thing. And I think that there is an increasing appetite for, you know, actually throwing the book at trainers who are cheating and who are drugging horses. But the whole reason it happened was because of those raids, which is something that we haven't seen. And that's what we said at the time when we were talking about that, was like, why isn't this happening frequently? Why isn't this happening all the time at every racetrack across the country? Like, you should be able to have a clean tack room, a clean barn area. If regulators want to come in and look around, like, you shouldn't have anything to hide. And it's just something that doesn't happen on racetracks. I can name you several dozen trainers right now that if you pop them, you know, when they weren't expecting it and weren't looking, I'm pretty sure you could find some illegal contraband. This guy just happened to be, you know, made an example of by the Pennsylvania Racing Commission. But yeah, I mean, you know, I can't speak to what was in the syringes or what was specifically found, but I'm going to assume from the 2-year suspension that they feel pretty good about what they found and that it's illegal in Pennsylvania and that he should be punished. And they're not really worried about what the lawyer says. I think that, you know, that's how you get the ball rolling, is to actually have someone come in and do some real investigative work. And then that kind of lays the groundwork for actual, you know, toothful suspensions of trainers. And I have no problem with it. I think, especially at a place like parks that I think John has spoken about, that I think a lot of people in the industry feel cheaters have been able to kind of run amok there. I think it's extremely important for Pennsylvania to come in and make an example out of somebody. And I hope that he's not the last one, because there are other trainers that I'm sure are in their crosshairs. I'm sure they weren't just looking for Richard Vega. So I think, again, deterrence. There's so much to be said about deterrence. And it's not just necessarily about this punishment for this guy. It's about creating an atmosphere where trainers are worried that someone's going to be knocking on their barn door at any time, and they have to be on the up and up at all times. That's what's most important. You know, I'm glad that there are some more sturdy suspensions being given to guys, and we'll see. Hopefully it holds up in court if he was doing the wrong things. But yeah, it starts with deterrence and investigation to make guys change their behavior so that we don't have to worry after the fact and debate about what the punishment was or should have been. John?
And I'm gonna jump in here and not only endorse what you said, but also add on Joe and Bill. I think it's a great start. And again, just like we did back in for the Memorial Day show, you know, I want to again extend kudos to Parks for actually taking the step and doing a raid and being more proactive with regard to looking to see what their trainers are doing. And it's interesting because, you know, when Richard Vega came up and as a name that was you know mentioned highly in the article, it didn't, you know, it kind of raised a little bit of suspicion on my end. But if you look at his numbers, if you're looking at it strictly from a numbers standpoint, here's a guy who's got like a 15-16% win percentage. So you wouldn't normally think, okay, well, that's a guy who's bending the rules or breaking the rules, because obviously he's not doing it well then if he's doing it at a 15% win percentage. There are certainly other trainers, and Joe, I think you alluded to this, there are other trainers at parks and around the country where you look at their win percentages alone and you say, something's up. Something doesn't make sense because either they are going to the Hall of Fame as far as being a trainer who can win at 25, 28%, 30%, or they're using something to enhance their opportunities. I think at the end of the day, though, it comes down to two points for me. Number one is that trainers have the ultimate and total responsibility for what goes on in their barn. So whether or not they're sharing a tack room with another person, which as far as I've seen on the backstretch, a trainer of that capacity that has that many horses, they don't share tack rooms. It's not something that's done. So I don't know where the lawyer is coming up with, well, it was a shared tack room and it wasn't our syringes. I think that's BS right from the start. But be that as it may, it's still, even if he shared a tack room, it's still Richard Vega's ultimate and total responsibility to know what's going on in that tack room. And just as a quick anecdote, we were going to run a first-time starter named Rosie Dawn at Ellis Park this weekend. And on Saturday morning, early in the morning, I got the dreaded call from a trainer where when you look at your phone at early in the morning and you go, oh, no. Mark Cassie called me and he said, I've never had this happen in all my years of training. But when our assistant trainer got to Ellis Park the morning of the race, he walked in at 4:45 in the morning to check on the horses. And a guy ran out of Rosie Dawn's stall. Didn't work for Mark Cassie, didn't work for anybody in the barn, heard some rustling going on with lights going on and ran out of her stall. Now, was it just coincidence that he was in the stall of a horse that we were running that day? I don't know. But what ended up happening is we had to scratch the horse. And we had to scratch the horse because it simply came down to we didn't see any images of you know questions of anything going on. There were no injection points. There were no blood spatters. There were no marks in you know in her mouth to show that maybe somebody had syringed you know some medication in her mouth. There was no alcohol swab. Nothing. No evidence whatsoever. But at the end of the day, the stewards came back to us and said, Mark Cassie, you can run this horse in this race. But if she comes up positive, it doesn't matter what story you give us. You're ultimately responsible. So we scratched the horse. Now, we did do a blood sample. We're waiting on those tests to see if anything comes back. But we took on the responsibility because we know that that's what happens. If you enter a horse in the backstretch, you have it in the stall, if it's in your barn, you are responsible for it, irrespective of who touches the horse or who's around the horse. So unfortunately, we had to scratch our 3-1 favorite in the Ellis Park race because somebody else maybe got drunk and slept in the stall or urinated in the stall or whatever example you want to come up with, excuse you want to come up with, we scratched the horse because that's what you have to do when you have ultimate responsibility. So enough of this bullshit crap, you know, excuses from people saying, well, I didn't know what was going on. We share a tag. It's all BS. You have the responsibility. You're a trainer. You're in the barn all the time. You should know what's going on. Nobody's planting syringes under the seat of your car to try to catch you and get you in a sting operation. The other thing that I wanted to say, and I know I'm going on a tangent here, is that this is the second time now where a trainer is identified for illegal use of drugs or, you know, contraband that was hired by somebody of significant power in racing. And it happened with Jason Service, where Dennis Drazen was running, you know, running Monmouth, and he was winning at a 33% clip. And now Sal DeBunda, who is also very respected in the industry and is president and chairman of the Horsemen's Board in Pennsylvania, and his trainer, Richard Vega, comes up positive, you know, for contraband. I think that as owners, you have to look in the mirror and say, what are these guys doing? How are they winning races? Is it because they're really good or because something's going on? Because at the end of the day, owners, it's your responsibility to hire the good people in the business.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw that a couple of years ago with Chuck Winter being involved with horses with Baffert while they were adjudicating the Bob Baffert, you know, Justify positive. That, yeah, that's I think one of the kind of the unsung problems in racing is owners who, you know, either use or are close with trainers that they probably know are doing the wrong things, who are also in positions of regulatory power. And I don't know how you stop that, because, you know, at the end of the day, you need people with insider knowledge in racing who are able to regulate the sport, but it creates a very messy situation sometimes where owners want to win races. So they get guys who bend the rules, but then they are also in positions of power. And, you know, I think only naturally can fall asleep on the job in that way. But that's a crazy story about Ellis. I kind of buried the lead there. Wow.
It's
I never heard of that.
Time, Joe, it's the first time it ever happened to us. And it's the first time it ever happened to Mark Cassie, who's been in the business even longer than we have. I'd never heard of something like that before. And again, it could have been something totally innocuous and innocent of a guy getting drunk or high and just falling asleep in a stall and waking up, you know, and being like, where the hell am I? What's going on? And sprinting out of there. But it was just strange that out of a, you know, Mark's got like 20 stalls there and Rosie Dawn's stall is kind of in the middle. And it wasn't even like there was a sign yet saying, you know, horses entered, you know, please do not disturb or anything like that. It was all, you know, early, early morning. So we just had to take, you know, we had to take it on the chin, unfortunately, and say, all right, we're going to scratch the horse because, you know, God forbid me stumping on the show and saying how important it is for owners to take a stand and you know, do the right thing. And then I get a horse that's DQ'd and then have to come on the show and say, oh, yeah, I got DQ'd because somebody we don't know randomly ran out of the stall. You guys would laugh me out of off the show.
See, the TDN writers room, keeping owners honest, including
one owner at a time.
We'll be right back after this message from the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project.
It's said that life is simply a series of memories we share with the ones we love. The experiences, the joys, the thrills. Imagine a life that includes meeting your very own racehorse for the first time. The thrill of watching your racehorse passing others one by one down this stretch, and then sharing the winner's circle celebration with those closest to you. Let the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project help guide you to the experiences and memories you deserve. Owning a racehorse is less expensive and more attainable than you think. Visit racehorseminnesota.com. That's racehorseminnesota.com, and begin making your memories this summer at Canterbury Park.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our guest this week is the CEO of West Point Thoroughbreds, back for the third time on this show, Terry Finley. Thanks so much for coming on.
So it's great to be on. And actually, the Green Group, they do our taxes as well, and they do a great job. So I'll drive that plug in for the Greens.
All right. So you don't get the free hour then. You are qualified for the free hour. Yeah, I feel like Terry should get a jacket. Like, you know how the SNL, they have the five timers jacket when they host the fifth time? We need like a third timers polo or something for Terry.
I think I was on, I don't know, 9 months ago or so, and I don't think a lot have happened. I don't think very many things have happened in the horse business, so I'm not sure we have a whole lot to talk about in the middle of July.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're waiting for Saratoga, but we certainly have a horse to talk about of interest for you guys. First Captain, who won the Dwyer Stakes on Monday to remain undefeated. He's now 3-for-3. He's an interesting horse. If you watch the show, we had a little back and forth about it. I think he's got a lot of talent, but we think he's got a little bit forward to move as well. What are your thoughts of him so far and his development through these three starts?
Yeah. So I think the same thing. You know, he's probably going to have to take another like a step forward. But I'm in a position, and all the partners are in a position. At least we're in a spot in the middle of his three-year year to take a step forward. So I guess that's a lot better than, you know, being in a spot where you have four or five levels to jump. But I think he's right on the cusp. And obviously so far, you know, he's 3 for 3 and he hasn't done a whole lot long. And he's been brought along by a pretty good trainer and in the likes of Shug McGahee and his team. So we're excited. And, you know, the thought of going to Saratoga, we've never gone to Saratoga with a, you know, the prospect of getting to the Travers. So that in and of itself is really, really exciting for, you know, all the partners and for the West Point team and everybody associated with us.
Hey, Terry, thanks for joining us. And it's interesting when you talk about First Captain, one of the things of the stories is this was a very pricey horse at the sales. You also have Flightline out on the West Coast, a huge prospect, very pricey. And it's not just you guys. It's Starlight, Eclipse Thoroughbreds. Over the last 2 or 3 years, the syndicates seem to just be going, have really, really upped their game. Whereas maybe 5, 6 years ago, you might have been in $100,000, $200,000 yearling. Now, you know, you're out there bidding with John Green for these seven-figure horses. And, you know, what is it about the world of the syndicates that now you guys have gone from, you know, big owners to, you know, mega big owners?
Yeah, Bill. So I'm not really sure exactly what the, and I don't think there's one answer to that. I don't think there's a, you know, a gotcha and a like I have the answer, but I do think it's any number of factors. And I think one of the big factors is that even individual owners are seeing, like, you know, when you sit right down and you look at the stats, right? It doesn't make sense in the vast majority of cases to pay, you know, over $500,000 for a horse because it's so tough to get a return on investment. So I think individual owners are starting to see that the partnerships, you know, they're trying to do a good job and they have a good model. And the fact that you're able to join forces, I think we see it in the outside world, quote unquote, you know, where companies are getting together to buy other companies. And I read the Wall Street Journal and, you know, I think that's starting to proliferate all over the world. And I think it's occurring in the thoroughbred business. I think it will continue to accelerate because, you know, to think, to go to Saratoga as an individual owner and to compete and to fight in the auction ring against the groups, because there are probably 3 or 4 groups, partnerships that are public that are bringing in individual owners. So all of a sudden, you look around and you're going to see Eclipse and you're going to see the Avengers. And, you know, there are some horses that all three of us have tried to buy. So I think it's exciting. I think it's very good for the partnerships because we have a chance to compete, you know, with the best horses or the best prospects, I should say. It takes time for them to get to the point where they're the best horses. But, you know, I just think it's a trend that's going to continue. And I think it's been a result of all the activity and all the work that partnerships have put into the business. And I think we'll talk about some of the other things that are going on in our industry. But I think across the board, you know, partnerships are going to get stronger and stronger as a whole.
Yeah. And Terry, in another interview, I heard you say that, you know, when the hammer went down on this horse on First Captain at $1.5 million, you were so excited and you didn't have any buyer's remorse, you know, after you signing the ticket and walking back and looking at the horse, which I found really fascinating because, you know, like you alluded to, you spend more than $400,000 or $500,000 on an animal and you got to be scratching your head saying, what am I doing? But for you to have that confidence at $1.5 million, walk us through, you know, was it just the horse's presence, or was it that he's, you know, so royally bred and from one of the top families in American racing, or that you knew you had other partners like the Manganeros and other people behind you, and that gave you what was the impetus to go to $1.5 million on this horse?
Yeah, so I think any number of things, John. The colt was raised at Stone Farm, and you know, Bobby Flay and his breeding program that he's built, and he's you know, starting to explode. I talked to him the other day, and you know, he was so excited the fact that, you know, you looked at the first two generations of this colt, and they're Bobby Flay generations, and Bobby Flay's team. So, you know, all of a sudden you start to look at, you got Bobby Flay, you got Stone Farm. I took the Mangoneros to dinner the night of the sale. And so we got up after dinner and we walked over to the Stone Farm consignment right there near the restaurant. And the first thing that they said is, we'll take 25%. You know, I think he had taken three steps out of his stall. You know, he was a horse that really captured your dreams and all the imagination that we all have when we buy horses. And we think, you know, the first thing you think about when you give any kind of money for a horse is you say, I could this be the one? And I tell you, I think more so than any horse we've ever bought, you know, that kept coming back to me. Could this be the one? And then before you know it, you know, I had a couple other people that expressed interest. And then after the sale, I talked to Bobby Flay and he stayed in for a nice chunk. So all those things give me confidence and they gave me consummate that night. And I think the next morning by 10 or 11 o'clock, the horse was fully syndicated. So I might have said on that podcast, there are a lot of times where I think we bought four or five horses for over $1 million. And every one of them, I don't know, I think it took 2 or 3 days. And you, so you compare and contrast that to, there are other horses we spend $300 or $400 on, and it takes a couple of weeks to get them syndicated. So I don't know, there's something, there's a sizzle and there's an attraction, especially to sale toppers, that, you know, obviously the sellers and the consigners and the sales companies all take advantage of. But, you know, I think it was the start of a very big dream that we all coalesced behind this colt. And, you know, so far, so good.
Right. And I think you're being a little modest, too, because years ago when you bought an expensive horse, it was harder to syndicate. But now you've had the, you know, you've had Jackson Traveler and Obesos and, you know, Always Dreaming. I mean, you have a resume yourself, a pedigree yourself to fall back on that makes people want to be a part of this. Do you think that's part of it? Because I know even like when we bought Turned Aside, you said, well, maybe I'll buy a third. And the next morning you were like, I need to buy half because we're oversubscribed.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I think we all know when we're into this game, right, is you got to stay humble. And if you don't stay humble, the game, I definitely will humble you. And, you know, I'm always telling myself, I mean, we've spent a good bit of money. We've invested a good bit of money for partners and for outside partners and inside partners over the last 10 years, you know, because we've got rolling. And I don't know. I'd like to have done better, you know, with the horses that we bought. There were plenty of horses that we bought that we had high hopes for that, you know, for one reason or another, didn't work out. And I don't downplay that. You know, I take responsibility for that. I'm the captain of the ship, and I stand up, and I, you know, when the good times they occur, I want to be part of it. But you know, when the wheels fall off, you know, I take responsibility as well. So I just think back, you know, I look at the humble side of things, and I think you really do have to stay humble, because as soon as you start to think that you have the secret sauce or that you're smarter than everybody else in the business, you really have a problem, right? Because nobody is smarter than everybody's trying. Everybody's got a lot of the same data. And I think a lot of cases, it just comes down to the forces, i.e. the money that you have behind me. And, you know, we've been encouraged and I say blessed, you know, to have people that get behind us and that give us the confidence to buy horses. But, you know, we have to show up every day. And I know that's trite, but it's a game where everybody's trying to get the first captains of the world and everybody's trying to get these good horses. So it's tough, but I think that's what attracts us, and that's what keeps us, you know, going to the sales every day and opening the TDN every day. I'll give a plug, which is what I do. I think a lot of us do. And so it's just a wonderful, I know, way to spend your life. I know we all love the horse business, but man, this is, you know, when things start to fall into place, as they seem to be doing now, you know, you really appreciate the fact that there are a lot of people that are involved and there's a lot of luck, and, you know, you just have to relish it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the places where there's the most optimism is Saratoga, Saratoga and Del Mar with a two-year-old season. You know, it's hard not to feel good and optimistic about racing when you got those two boutique meets going on. And I noticed, you know, we talked to you last when we were at the OBS spring sale. You guys were very active there. Like, you've been especially active this year at the two-year-old sales. So now we've had that's a couple months in the rear view. Now they're presumably at the track getting ready to run. What do you think about your crop of two-year-olds this year? And have you been able to bring on new partners that you haven't had before with this year's group of two-year-olds?
Yes. So I tell you, Joe, we've been very, very happy. And I'd love to talk about, you know, some of the reasons I think people are, you know, attracted to ownership. But I'd say no doubt, you know, Saratoga and Del Mar, you know, we endeavored about 10 years ago, you know, as the Saratoga meets and the partnerships have, you know, really started to take off, that we weren't going to point to Saratoga and to Del Mar in such a way that we hurt the operation of the stable, because it's very easy, right? You get to the middle of May or the beginning of June, and you know the Del Mar and the Saratoga thoughts, they dominate your mind, and you know, maybe you don't run in a spot that you should have to get ready for Saratoga. So we really have, I think, held ourselves accountable to not do that. But when I look at our roster, I think things are falling into place, right? But I do know owners and trainers all across the country that are gonna compete at Del Mar and Saratoga. They're saying the same thing, right? We can't wait. We're locked and loaded for Saratoga. You go on this on the backside. You go to Oklahoma at Saratoga. You will not find a trainer that doesn't think he's going to have his best meet ever at Saratoga. And if you do, that's a small portion of the trainers that are, you know, every day working hard back there. And I think the same thing with, you know, owners and partners across the country. So, you know, it's really the place to be in August, right? We all know that. But especially this year, you know, the fans and the stands are going to be packed to the gills. And, you know, it seems like the racing is on in both places is going to be as best, as good as it's ever been. So we're just excited about it.
Hey, Terry, let me switch gears for a minute. And you watch the show and you know what we like to talk about in industry issues. And, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't appear that we can get through a single show because we're not afraid to tackle the issues of, you know, integrity issues. And, you know, it's the weekly police blotter. And before you came on, more so John and Joe were talking. We were talking about what was going on at Parks with the raid there and then the trainer getting 2 years. And they brought up something I thought was very interesting and something that we probably be a good subject to tackle with you, that at the end of the day, owners are responsible. Owners choose these trainers, the guys that are too good to be true, the guys that you, hey, know, have to know that something is going on. Now, that doesn't include West Point. I mean, you only deal with people that have squeaky clean reputations, and good for you for that. But, you know, take us through your thoughts on the owner's responsibility for helping clean up this sport. And if they don't, if there's a guy out there that goes from 30% trainer to 30% trainer to 30% trainer, how can we hold them responsible and maybe make, at the end of the day, penalize owners as well? Because yes, I agree with John and Joe. If more people were doing the right thing from the ownership side, obviously this problem wouldn't be as bad as it is.
Yeah, that's the question of the industry, Bill, right? And I think some, you know, very salient point. You know, we have to play a part of it, the owners. And I'm not accepting of the guys who, you know, they're at 30% and they've made a lot of money and they've got a lot of pictures taken, and then their trainer gets popped and they're like, you know, wait a second, I didn't know, what was I? Yeah, so I understand that. And, you know, so it's a complex situation. There's no doubt. But, you know, now, you know, we've seen the situations, like now we have to say all we can control is today and the things we do going forward. So I just ask owners out there, if you're a trainer, right, spent like 20 years at 14%. And they had 14% horses. And they've increased a little bit, and they probably could be or should be at 16 or at the 17% level, and they're at 29%. You should ask questions. You know, what have you done, right? Because there aren't enough variables in training a horse to move an operation, the same operation from 17 to 29. I think we all know that. So I think at the very basic, at that level, you just have to ask questions, and you have to raise an eyebrow, because although people, you know, trainers can get hot and they go, if they get hot for a couple months, right, you have to have a downward trough and you have to come back. And, you know, the people who go up and down, I'm accepting of that. But the people that just go right from, you know, 17 to 29, I'm not accepting anymore. And I will tell you, you know, the industry, I said it to somebody the other day, you know, people who are not doing the right thing, you know, they have to be aware that their text messages and their phone calls and their conversations with people. And, you know, we all know that people are on our backsides across the country, and they're selling that crap, and they're representing that, you know, the stuff that they're selling is the elixir. And I think people have to expose those people on the backside that are trying to peddle and trying to influence our game. So, look, everybody can do their part. And I think we're getting to the point where people, the industry certainly, and the major organizations have stood up and say no more. And they've said no more. And, you know, we're going to address this. And I don't know. I'm positive. I think it's, although we're airing our dirty laundry, I think people appreciate the fact that our industry is stepping up and we're addressing. Obviously Bob Baffert is the face and the voice of our industry up to now. And I think people, I've talked to potential owners that saying, like, I know it's not going to happen overnight, but I appreciate your industry, and they're stepping up and they're addressing and they're tackling the tough issues and the tough circumstances and they're putting aside the fact that somebody is a celebrity and a big time figure and you know, has won the Derby like a bunch of times. So, you know, I just think in the long run, I look at this in a positive light that that we're going to go through the same thing that cycling did and the baseball world and other sports, right, that had problems, and they're not perfect, but they've shown to their constituents and to the public that they have the gumption to stand up and to take action. And I think that's what we've done.
Yeah, and Terry, I really appreciate that. It resonates with me as an owner and also as hopefully somebody that tries to do the right thing. And I've always taken a page out of your leadership book, as far as, you know, you went to NYTHA and helped, you know, that situation with New York Racing with a lot of other good people that are there. And now you're a member on the board of Breeders' Cup. And it's because of leadership like yours that is helping move the pendulum in the other direction. And I mentioned it on the show during sale, you know, during yearling time last year, about how pleased I was that in the pre-sale announcements, Keeneland not only announced, you know, that, you know, this is your responsibility, you buy the horse and blah, 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 but they also said dual agency is against the law in the state, in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And we're trying to clean up things in racing. Can you also talk a little bit about how the industry is trying to clean itself up on the auction side? Because I really feel like that things are going in the right direction. And that's also part of the reason why, you know, organizations like yours are doing so well because people feel better about buying a horse at the sales.
Well, I agree, John. You know, the sales are a spot where we understand that the sellers and the sales companies, you know, their main focus is to get horses sold. But when you peel back that onion, you know, we needed to make some changes. We needed to do drug testing and we need to continue to refine that process. And I don't know, I think that the vision would be to incorporate the sales process and the sales side of things, you know, once we get HISA up and running, I would think that would be the next step in really synchronizing our business. So look, I think it comes back to, you know, we don't have to fight about everything. We might not agree and we might have different perspectives, but you know, we're people who love our game. So we just need to take the concept of sitting down and talking through our differences, right? And getting to a point where we compromise on things that make sense on both sides. So why do you understand selling horses is not easy? And when, you know, that's your Super Bowl, the day that the horse walks through the ring. And I understand that the sales companies, you know, first and foremost, they represent the seller. But we understand that a good portion of the new people that come into our business are acquiring horses via the auction route. And so I think the more transparent that we make that, the better. And, you know, the two-year-old sales, I think the two of us have been active at the two-year-old sales. And I think there's quite a bit of upside, staying on the positive, there's quite a bit of upside and changes that can be made to make it better for everybody. And I think that's the key, is that you have to make it and you have to incorporate all the competing interests at the table. And, you know, we can't be afraid to compromise on the things that should be compromised on. I'm not talking about the integrity issues, but, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, you can look at the same situation in a different light, depending on what side of the transaction you're on. But hey, we're talking about it, we're aware of things. And I don't know, I just think we really are, we've put ourselves in a position through the work of, the Jockey Club and other organizations and a lot of individuals that care about our industry and that want to pass it on to our children and our grandchildren. Like I think we've made a lot of great strides in the last couple of years.
Let's keep talking about it. I think that's the way to go going forward. And Terry, thank you so much as always for all the insights. And we can't wait to see you at Saratoga, we hope.
So I sit in the same spot. I was going to say, you need to bring up to Sue. You probably need to have a week out at Del Mar and you'll do the show out there. Maybe do two or three. And then you go to Saratoga around the sales. You got to be at the action. So tell Sue that if you would.
All right. I prefer this Finley.
Terry, anytime you want to sponsor that trip, I'm willing to accept that check.
I'll get back to you on that, Sue. I will get back to you.
That's great.
All right, thanks, Terry.
Yeah, no, thank you, Terry. That was excellent. Thank you.
Absolutely. See you guys.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Terry Finley will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. Be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is sponsored by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Before we sign off today, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the passing of Harvey Pack. Harvey Pack died yesterday at 94 years old. If you don't know who Harvey Pack was, he was a racing broadcaster who I thought really brought life to racing and racing replays and highlights. He had shows back when there was Sports Channel, which was like one of the first really exclusive New York sports broadcasting channels. He had a racing recap show on there, and I remember him most as a somewhat younger person of being the host of the Ciro seminars at Saratoga. With the Daily Racing Forum, with Andy Serling, and condolences to Andy. I know he and Harvey were very close, but I remember him bringing levity and light to those handicapping seminars, which can be kind of dry sometimes and a little boring, but Harvey always had a story or a joke or something to lighten the mood. And that's kind of the way that I remember him, is that he was a unique personality and didn't mind showing his personality and, you know, regaling people with the other personalities of the racetrack and of racing, because it really is an interesting, quirky world that I don't think is always broadcasted that way. I think it's sometimes taken a little bit too seriously by people within racing. And that was not Harvey Peck. Harvey Peck liked to have fun with the sport. And I think that he created a lot of thoroughbred racing fans in New York over the years with that attitude and with that kind of approach to covering racing. So rest in peace, Harvey Peck, and condolences to everybody that knew him and was friends with him. He was certainly one of a kind, and I think, you know, a real legend, especially in New York and in the New York racing world.
Yeah, Joe, you really hit the nail on the head. What made Harvey very special was that he got it. He got it that this game really should be fun. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there that take themselves and the sport too seriously. Look, at the end of the day, we're all kind of downtrodden horse players anyway. And he really understood that. And I was fortunate enough to work with Harvey. I was on his daily show many, many times, I mean, hundreds of times back in the 90s and 80s when they did the recap show on Sports Channel. Just one little anecdote to let you know how big Harvey was. At the time I was writing for the New York Daily News, which is now an embarrassment. I mean, it's a terrible newspaper that nobody reads. Back then, it was a huge deal. Matter of fact, for a while, we were the number one circulation daily metropolitan paper in the entire country. We say daily metropolitan only because USA Today had more circulation. I would walk through the grandstand of Belmont or Saratoga or even other racetracks around the country, like Suffolk Downs, and invariably people would come up to me and say, "Hey, I saw you on Harvey." What was the name of it? It wasn't the Harvey Peck Show. It was like Thoroughbred Action or something like that. But they'd say, "Hey, I saw you, Finley, last night on the Harvey Peck Show. And oh, I can't believe you liked that horse that paid $16, et cetera, et cetera." Almost never did anybody say, "Hey, I really like the story you wrote in the Daily News yesterday." It was always about Harvey Peck. And, you know, I was a celebrity to these people because I rubbed elbows with Harvey Peck. He was on his show once a week. And you know what? I don't know where it would come from, but we could use a lot more Harvey Pecks in this industry. And look, I know it is a serious business, but at the end of the day, emulate Harvey. Have a smile on your face. Realize that this is all about having fun. And also, it, like you said, John, it's such a quirky world out there. There's a million characters and a million stories. And when it comes to that aspect of the game, nobody did it better than Harvey Peck.
We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse, every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Okay, so that's going to do it for hopefully our last Zoom edition of the TDF Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Reminder that the Keeneland September Yearling Sale starts Monday, September 13th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guests of the week, Terry Finley, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you next week from the studio.